Welcome to Black Blood Hills, brought to you by NMDP. NMDP manages the world's most diverse blood stem cell donor registry. Tune in each week as I share tools and resources on ways you can be a change agent and save a life in your community. Welcome to Black Blood Hills. I'm your host, Tamara Weston, and today I am joined by another Morehouse man. You guys know, I feel like that is the school. I'm joined today by Dr. Jason Payne, who is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Morehouse Medical School. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Tamara.
How are you, Dr. Payne?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm really glad to be here. Glad that you invited me here to talk about one of my passions, sickle cell disease. So,
and we're going to talk about that passion because I have heard some things about you. I was introduced by one of the administrators at Morehouse School of Medicine, and she was adamant that I needed to get to know you because you were, I guess, going to take the baton and run with it. So I'm glad that you're able to join us today.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. So a little bit about myself. I am actually from Georgia. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Georgia. Okay. Then actually went to medical school at Morehouse School of Medicine. And so I've actually come full circle. Wow. And I'm now on as faculty at Morehouse School of Medicine. After I graduated from medical school, I did my training at in pediatrics. So I'm a pediatrician. Mm-hmm. Did that at MUSC in Charleston, South Carolina. And then I did my fellowship at UAB in Birmingham. Okay. And so at the Children's of Alabama and in Charleston, South Carolina, and now I'm back in Atlanta. And so I can tell you all about how we treat kids all around the South.
Well, let's just first talk about how does it feel to now be teaching at the school that taught you?
It's, you know, when I was there, I never thought I would come back and be a teacher. Okay. But here I am. And, you know, one of the biggest reasons I went to Morehouse School of Medicine is because they actually invest in people who want to give back to the community.
Okay.
They understand the need that there's not enough Black and Brown pediatricians, internal medicine doctors. There's not enough Black and Brown doctors, period. And so Morehouse School of Medicine invests in their students. And so it's really great to come back and now be a part of that investment.
And just think, you are now continuing that legacy, not only as a professor, but you're teaching our future. That's got to be an amazing feeling.
It is. You know what would be even better?
What?
Is I can get one of these students to just go into pediatric hematology. Maybe even like adult hematology at that. Okay. I just want one. Just one.
Okay. All you need is one.
All I need is one.
And you listen, you got a long way to go. I'm sure you're going to get them.
I'm going to do it.
Yes, you are. And I love it. I love it. You touched on something that I kind of want to kind of segue into now. So you noted that we need a lot more Black and Brown physicians, correct? Like it's adamant. I can tell you from my own personal experiences, when looking for a physician at this stage in my life, I try to find a African American, if I can, a female, because I feel like she will know more of what I'm feeling. And as I try to describe it, I'm sure you hear descriptions all the time, but from my perspective, an African-American female doctor would know. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It really is hard. And it's also a little bit deflating because you kind of now have to settle for someone else. And you're like, wow, I wish, you know, there were more. Where do you see that happening or where do you see that going in the near future? Or what's your wish list for that?
Yeah, you know, I guess, so when I went into pediatrics, I didn't know that I was going to go into pediatric hematology and oncology and be involved in this space. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of those same experiences that you're talking about. And so when I was in my residency, I was taking care of people with pediatric cancer and and blood disorders and also kids with sickle cell disease. And those patients started to gravitate toward me. You know, I felt like, you know, they were able to connect a little bit differently and feel able to really talk to me about what they're experiencing. And the thing about sickle cell disease is that, you know, they experience something like vaso-occlusive crisis or pain. Mm-hmm. And pain is completely subjective. And so when we talk about pain, we have to really understand and believe what our patients are feeling. And so for them to feel vulnerable, they have to feel a connection with their doctors and their providers.
And I have heard from searching patients, parents of children that NMDP manages and supports, that a lot of times they've gone to the hospital. And as you mentioned, the pain and the crises, and, you know, there have been some underlining suggestions that people are there not because of the pain, as you said, is subjective, right? Mm-hmm. But more so for the medicine.
Right.
And usually, yes. And usually that comes from physicians that don't look like them. Have you had that experience? Have patients told you that as well?
Patients tell me this all the time, actually. Mm-hmm. And so we try to really be an advocate for our patients. We tell them, you know, call the hematologist, call your hematologist. We can talk to that other doctor and advocate on your behalf, right? Mm-hmm. And so we really try to make sure that our patients feel comfortable, that they can talk to us about that. But much as like there's not enough Black and Brown doctors, very similarly with NMDP, there's not enough Black and Brown donors.
Let's say that again.
You know, and it's really mirroring that same thing. There's not enough Black and Brown doctors and not enough Black and Brown donors. And really, so the only way that we can really even the playing field is really just get involved.
Absolutely. When we talk about donors, when we talk about African-American specific, let's talk a little bit about, I won't say requirements, but let's talk about the preference. Absolutely. We want a lot of people to join the registry. We want men, women between the ages of 18 and 34, we want them to join the registry, which is a sweet spot. To join the registry, you need to be between 18 and 40. A lot of times there has been a little bit of backlash because people say, well, you don't want anyone over 40 because why? We go into the explanation that based on scientific information, stem cells from younger donors between the ages close to 18, but, you know, between the ages of 18 and 34, help a patient sort of rehabilitate faster and recover faster.
Science is there, and it's there to help guide our decisions in the future, right? And so if we know that we get better stem cell products from donors that are younger, I think we should use that younger product. The way I like to spin that is, if you were on the recipient side, right, mm-hmm. wouldn't you want to have the best chance of beating whatever cancer, whatever disease that you're trying to beat with this transplant, right? Mm-hmm. And so you want to have the best product, the best donor to give you those stem cells and give you that fighting chance.
And when we talk about, and again, I might be using a wrong phrase, but if I do, definitely correct me. When we talk about the youth of the stem cells, are we talking about it because the stem cells are stronger? Are they more vibrant? Like, what specifically, if you can, break it down in terms of why we would want from a younger donor?
So our stem cells, the whole purpose of our stem cells is to constitute our immune system, mm-hmm. right? They help fight off different infections. They help identify us as us. And so the younger those stem cells are, the better they are at fighting off those infections, the better that they are at replicating. And so when people have to donate, they do have to, you know, those stem cells have to replenish themselves. And so younger stem cells are able to do that at a better rate.
Okay. So in terms of finding a donor, which, you know, in my perfect world, or what I think would be a perfect scenario, is that every searching patient would have the option of maybe four matches, right? The best matches. And the doctor has to go in now and select which match is best, right? So now let's just for giggles, let's say we have one searching patient that has three matching donors. One matching donor is, say, you know, 49. And then the second matching donor is, say, 39. And then the third matching donor, let's just say, is 24. Would they select those donors based on age, or is it another set of requirements or a set of things that they look at, not just age?
Sure, yeah. So age would be one of those criteria.
Is that
right?
The top criteria?
I don't know. So I'm not a transplanter, so I don't want to like give like actual like medical advice about this. But yeah, so when we do look at the different things that are involved in like in the transplant, age of the stem cells is important. Mm-hmm. Then you also want to look at like the medical history of the patient who is donating.
Okay.
Right? And so you may have someone who is 20, but who also may have like a chronic illness, right? Mm. And so that may preclude them from donating versus someone who may be a little bit older who has otherwise had a very healthy life. So I do think there's all these other criteria that are involved, not just age.
So for clarity, you can still join the registry. And if you are called, and even if you're in a pool, there's a chance that you may be selected to be the best match for that searching patient. So it doesn't mean, you know, if you don't feel like you're old, you're young enough that you shouldn't join. Just want to make sure that we always give that point of reference that while age is a factor, it is not the only factor. Well, then let's sort of pivot a little bit.
Yeah.
When we talk about donating, we know that African-American men are sort of, I don't want to say looked at more, but they would sort of be a preference over African-American women. Is that also because of stem cells and the strength of stem cells?
I don't believe that's just because of the strength of the stem cells. I think that also has to relate that females actually can have children. Mm-hmm. So and having children and having that history of having children can actually change how our body creates antibodies and things like that. And so that can make the process of donating or getting a transplant a little bit more difficult.
Got you. Okay. All right. So I know that at NMDP, we absolutely love to go into the communities, talk more to men, hopefully try to get them to listen a little bit more. We have had some success with going out into the community, getting men at events to join. So clearly it is really an understanding when we think about education, when we think about understanding the need, we think about who is going to be on the other end of receiving those stem cells. What are some of your thoughts in regards to how we can get more, not just African-Americans, but more African-American men to join the registry?
So when I thought about joining the registry, I did it when I was in fellowship, mm-hmm. and I did it after taking care of people who were actually getting those bone marrow transplants. Mm-hmm. Understanding that, so I'm half Black and half Filipino. Mm-hmm. And so that makes things a little bit more difficult mm-hmm. for when it comes to when there's an opportunity if I were to ever need a transplant in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I joined the registries for that one other kid that maybe I could be that HLA mm-hmm. match for, mm-hmm. that maybe I can be that opportunity to really fight that disease. And so when we're talking about the differences when people are approaching the match and their chances of fighting this disease or whatever disease that they have that they're going to get a transplant for, African-Americans, they have a 29% chance
yes.
of finding a match
yes.
versus what about 79% if you are mm-hmm. Caucasian or white, right? And so when we talk about evening the playing field, we're talking about actually getting more people of color in the registry so that if there is a person of color who does need a transplant in the future, they have a better shot of getting that match, of finding that donor who can help cure their disease.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that we did have a previous guest who we talked about the Black Latino community and the Black Caribbean community. And to you, what you just said, there is a difference for someone whose parents both identify as African-American versus a searching patient whose parents may identify as Black or Filipino.
Exactly.
For someone who's Black and Filipino, the chances of finding a match are slimmer because of the HLA testing. So I think understanding that too in the community is helpful. For us, it's actually getting into the community. It's actually being able to set up at the places where people are, you know, frequenting. Mm-hmm. So we try to navigate and touch on barbershops and beauty salons and anywhere where, for lack of a better term, Black folks are not guarded, right? Where they don't think someone is just coming at them because they want something. We want to be in places where we can actually provide the information and they're willing to take the time to listen. So I applaud you for understanding that. And when you are with your patients, are there any questions that you receive that might show or sort of identify barriers that might stop people from joining the registry?
Yeah, so there's a lot of barriers. When you look at the history of Black people and their interactions with the healthcare system, mm-hmm. there's a lot of history behind that, right? And
absolutely.
So there's a lot of mistrust mm-hmm. up front, right? And so when we're talking about things like donating, we're talking about giving of ourselves.
Right.
And so we're asking another thing of someone. And so when there's a little bit of that along with mistrust, that can make that decision to want to be a part of something like donating or being a part of a registry mm-hmm. a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's definitely one of the barriers that I do think that is existing. Right. And so, you know, I think the way we combat that is really just talking about it with our patients one-on-one, talking about, you know, what does it mean to be a part of the registry? What could that decision mean for someone who may need that, you know, bone marrow transplant in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess, Tamara, I do have that question for you because this is probably the best time to talk about it. Is one of the questions I do get is that if someone joins a registry, could their DNA be used for like crime evidence in the future?
Like, that is an amazing question. And thank you for flipping it, because now I feel like the highlight is on me.
But, it's a question I get a lot, though, and it's an absolute barrier. I want to be very honest.
And you should. We've gotten that question. We've done focus groups, and we've gotten that same question. And even being out in the community, we've gotten the same question. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, it's a valid question. There is not an opportunity. NMDP follows every letter of the law in terms of what they can and cannot do. There's HIPAA. There's also governmental protection laws. So NMDP is immaculate on making sure that we follow those rules and we follow those regulations. Your DNA is not given out or supplied outside of anything other than being a match on a registry. And just for, let me try to sort of give you a little bit of more background on how we do this. So to join a registry, it is done through a swab. And then there's an identifying number that is placed on that envelope. That envelope goes down to the biorepository. The biorepository takes that swab, which is now called a sample, and that sample now goes through a series of tests just to make sure that, or where it can land in terms of the research process. Once it goes through the test, it is then logged, and then you will receive an email, and it can take between 3 to 6 weeks, but you'll receive an email or some form of notification that you are now officially on the registry. That means that your sample has been tested, your sample has been logged, and it has now been included and will be included moving forward for all searching for all patients nationwide. And that is it. There is nothing that is given out or distributed. If you find that your sample is a match, or if it turns out that your sample is a match, a representative from our response team will reach out to you. And I have to tell you, and you guys have heard it, if we can't find you from that first call, we will hunt you down. They will call every number that you have listed, because again, there's no guarantee you're going to be called right away. It can take 1 year, it can take 5 years, it can take 10 years, or you may never be called. There is no guarantee. But if you are called, someone will reach out to you, they will find you, and they will ask you if you're still committed. That is the process of that swab. There is never any opportunity that it will be used outside of becoming a match for a searching patient.
That's wonderful. I mean, I'm just glad you're able to really provide that transparency and actually walk from the moment that sample is collected to when it's included into the registry. I think a lot of people will really benefit just from hearing that information, knowing that their sample is safe like that.
And I'm glad that you asked that, because I don't think we've ever talked about the process of it. I don't want people to think that it's right away. It does take time to process. It is not a you sign up on June 13th and then on June 14th, you're now a member of the registry. It does go through a process, and it could take up to 6 weeks.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you for that question. I love it. I love it. So tell us a little bit about your day to day in working with pediatric patients. If you still do, or are you just in a teaching role?
No, so I do patient care. So actually, around 70% of what I do currently is actually in clinical care.
Okay.
And so I have a clinic that is there. I see patients twice a week. Mm-hmm. And then other weeks, I actually will cover an inpatient service where I'll serve as a pediatric hematologist and get hematology consults. Okay. So any patients with any kind of blood disorder, they'll consult me.
So here's what I'm going to ask you now, because I've often wondered about it. We often think that doctors are stoic. They have no feelings. That is just a script that they're following. Is there ever an opportunity that you become emotionally impacted by what you do?
That's a day-to-day thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I take what I do really serious, and I think it's a privilege that I get to be a Black and Brown doctor, and I get to serve my patients in that capacity. And so I do take every day as a privilege to serve my patients. And so every day I do think, you know, some days are kind of routine, but then there's other days that really kind of like tug at your core, and it's like, man, I cannot believe this family's dealing with this, or I can't believe we don't have a new way to, you know, cure this, you know, or how can we help this family who's dealing with something that's completely outside of their medical condition, right? And so I do see patients that are just living the effects of life, and, you know, and living life with a medical illness on top of it can make things really difficult.
When you think about the journey of a pediatric patient, and you know, you've clearly have the educational experience. Do you feel like there's been any changes or any shifts in the way that we treat cancer patients from a stem cell therapy perspective or just in general? Yeah.
I like to tell patients this all the time. So in my training, we had CAR T cells. CAR T cells was a new thing that we were just talking about. And so, and that was just years ago, right? And so if we think about some of the children who are diagnosed with cancer at younger ages, the therapies that are available to them today are newer and more safer. Okay. And so there's more and more opportunities to help cure their diseases in different and safer ways.
Okay. So when we get to the stage of discussing stem cell therapy, does that mean that they've exhausted those options? Or is that just, I won't say just, that seems like making it lower than it is. Is there a need for them to now be talking about stem cell therapy?
So stem cell therapy can be upfront for certain diseases mm-hmm. and second line therapy for other types of diseases. And so there's lots of different ways to kind of look at stem cell therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I do think with the medical advances that we have now, stem cell therapy is becoming safer okay. and we're able to now use different protocols that are safer, things that have less side effects like graft versus host disease. Mm-hmm. And we're able to now like know more about what are the effects of stem cell. And then some of that just comes with time.
Okay.
But the cool thing about pediatrics is that I get to watch these kids from when they were young babies grow into young adults. And so as they get older, I mean, the therapies that are becoming available in our day and age are just changing every single day.
I love it. I love it. How are your relationships with the parents? I know the children are your patients, but the conversations are with the parents. Mm-hmm. So how do those go from time to time?
Yeah, so sometimes you have to have some difficult conversations with parents, but I like to talk with parents that tell them that, you know, I'm your doctor here in the clinic, but, you know, you're my eyes and ears outside of mm-hmm. the clinic, right? And ultimately, this is your child. Mm-hmm. And so they're really invested in wanting the best for their child,
absolutely.
Right? And so one of the things medical students ask me about all the time, like, how do you deal with their parents? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I like to think that most parents are really doing whatever they can to have the best outcome for their kid.
Absolutely.
Right? They want their kid to go to the best school. They want them to be able to, you know, grow up and without any medical problems, not have to go to the hospital for things. And so they want to do what's best for their kid. And so I like to think that once you establish a good relationship with a parent and let them know that you're on their side, mm-hmm. that we both have the same interests at hand, we just want your kid to be better. Mm-hmm. And you want the same thing too, right?
Absolutely.
And so once you establish that, I think that's how you move that relationship forward.
I love it. And of course, we know that the parents are their biggest advocates, right?
Absolutely.
As you said, they want the best. They want to know that their children are receiving the best. Do you find that parents do a lot of research and they come back and say, well, what about this? Or what about this? What about this? So now they're like the Dr. Google and they're like, hey, I read this. So what can we do about that?
In this day and age, I expect that the parents have done that. I mean, everything is available right in your hand.
Yes.
So even if they just thought about it right then, they could have Googled it right when they were in the waiting room, mm-hmm. right? And then they come with these questions. And so I am prepared to like answer those questions. Okay. I do expect that parents have done their own research and they're coming to the doctor for that second opinion mm-hmm. to really validate what did they read online? Mm-hmm. Is that true? Is this really what we should be thinking about? Or is this something new that we should maybe add a new therapy for a child?
And that comes with the trust, right? They've
exactly.
read it, they want to know. So they're coming to you to get the best piece of advice and information. I think that, you know, as we move forward, as NMDP moves forward with their research and all of the clinical trials that they're doing to try to make stem cell therapy matching via HLA testing more productive. We've talked about the 8 out of 8. We've talked about the haplo. We've talked about, you know, familiar matches versus unrelated donor matches. So there's a lot of research. There's a lot of trials that are going on because like you said, it's changing, right? Mm-hmm. It's getting better. We want to make it better. It won't happen overnight. We know that, unfortunately, but it is happening. So when we think about searching patients that don't have a donor right now, what would you say to them?
So what I would tell them is really use your resources. Mm-hmm. One, using things like the NMDP to help spread that message. Reach out to the community and really see if there's other ways that we can get people that look like you to be a part of the registry. Because really, I think that's the one way that we can help increase the opportunities for people to have an actual match and a chance of curing their whatever their disease is, mm-hmm. is actually have more people that look like them in the registry. Mm-hmm. And so utilize the resources, get in touch with the community, find advocates that really can advocate for your cause and the ways that we can actually increase the registry diversity.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's amazing and great way to end this session. You can help someone, even if it's just one person, right?
All you need is one.
All you need is one. So just consider that and know that regardless of what you think you may not be able to do, you never know. It could be a flip and you can absolutely do what you think you can't do. So learn more about the registry. Visit us at nmdp.org. Find out information, research, and again, make that decision that's best for you. Because as I always say, in the end, it will take all of us to save just one of us. Thank you for tuning in to Black Blood Heals. Head over to nmdp.org for more information on how you can join the registry and get involved. Make sure you subscribe, share, and tell a friend about Black Blood Heals.